Welcome back to Startup to Success with Dr. Sharest, who is here sharing his journey, his why, and we're going to dive a little bit more into civic literacy and democracy. So my next question is, how do you define civic literacy today, especially in a time of polarization and misinformation out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I take a really broad view of civic literacy. I got involved in community engaged work as a high school teacher on the south side of Chicago, working with students and families and community organizers. And so, I really got interested in, I was a high school teacher at the time, and I was thinking about, what are the strategies and the tactics and the ideas that community organizers, so people who work in communities to kind of address long-standing problems, what about these strategies, or what from this, kind of toolbox of strategies could teachers benefit? I was a teacher working on the south side of Chicago. I didn't grow up there. I didn't live in the neighborhood, but I wanted to work with the students and the community. And I saw a lot of my colleagues who were very reticent about leaving the school and getting involved in community. And so, my book, Civic Literacy, is really about what I learned through that process, what I learned from community organizers, what I learned from the families, what I learned from the students, and what I think future educators should know about. Oftentimes, I think in an ideal world, we would have teachers who are from their communities, working in the schools in those communities, and there are programs like Grow Your Own Teachers that exist to try to facilitate that. But in a lot of school districts, you find that the teachers, aren't from the communities and didn't grow up there. And so my book is really about trying to address that that question of how do we prepare teachers to do this work. To go circle back though to your question, I mean, for me, being civically literate is understanding not just how government functions, like at the local, state, and federal levels, and I think those are important things to know about, but it's really about understanding how does power work within, the spaces that I operate in. So if I'm a student and I live on the south side of Chicago and I see a problem, do I have a set of tools that will allow me to work with others to address that problem? And so, community organizers talk about, people power, and there's money power. And if you don't have money power, what you're left with is people power. So how do you organize people in such a way that you can address the challenges and get, government to respond to the needs that you have in your community? So to me, civic literacy is about learning about those levers and understanding how power operates across different spaces, how to work with other individuals, how to relate with other people, how to identify what motivates people to get active in a community. All of those things really fall under that umbrella of civic literacy for me.
I'm so fascinated by this conversation because, I've been in advertising for over almost 2 decades now in marketing and advertising. And it wasn't until my time at New York Times when I decided to do a city takeover, which included people in the community. And it
Sure.
included I actually assigned my team to go and analyze and understand the community before we go out there and engage with them and promote a product. And ever since then, my mindset with advertising shifted. I started respecting communities. I started understanding and learning about their habits,
Sure.
the nationalities, the cultures, their buying habits, just overall understanding what's important in the community before introducing a new brand
Yeah.
in that community.
Sure.
And I
Yeah.
and that was that to me was a game changer in my career, because I realized that sometimes all you have to do is just respect and pay attention to the people that you're surrounded by, and just understand it's not necessarily just politics and people with money.
Right.
There's so much more to our community. We are all people. We're part of that community, and we all if we're all together, we can move big things and make things
Absolutely.
happen. But it's just, ha having that respect and acknowledging it and understanding, yes, we have social media, and obviously our social media can broaden your community, right, and make it
Right.
global. But my agency slogan is globally minded and locally connected for a reason, because I'm huge on the local connections and
Yeah.
that. So I love this conversation. I'm learning so
Yeah.
much and I'm just fascinated by it. But what advice do you have for young people if they want to
Yeah.
build civic engagement habits, even
Sure.
if they feel disconnected from politics?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a saying in community organizing, that the people with the problems are the people with the solutions. And so I would say to young people that if if there are issues that you and your peer group and your friends are facing, and you're feeling like you're not being heard on that issue, that there is the possibility for you to make change if you're willing to take some of those steps and do some of that groundwork, starting by talking to people, listening to people, doing that kind of community analysis, if you will, figuring out who are the people within your institution, whether it's your school or local government, who have the power to actually do something about the issue that concerns you. So yeah, I mean, I think young people really, I have two young children of my own, 14 and 16, two boys. They've got a lot of energy and they've got a lot of ideas, and so do their friends. And so, I look to them and I see real possibility for change, even as you say, in these polarizing times. This that energy that I think that the youth can bring, to the table. They've got their opinions and they've got ideas, and I think kind of harnessing that and trying to figure out, okay, so what can we do with this? But I would say, remain hopeful and connect with others, and you will be surprised at what's possible.
I love that. Great advice. Let's talk a little bit about Cuba.
Sure. Yeah.
Excuse me. What contrasts between US and Cuba most challenged your students' assumptions about democracy?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, depend on who you speak to
I'm
about
best.
the Cuban government.
Right.
Cubans, when they're on the record, will say that, they have a functioning democracy. Off the record, I think they have some, I think, valid criticisms of the way that the government functions there. But I would say, one thing that I think we could learn from the Cuban system is the way that they have, community-based assemblies, and sort of a kind of a mutual aid network that they've established within communities. So coming together to talk about the issues that are kind of most relevant to the local community, identifying who the people are who can help address those issues. I think that's a really, I think, powerful model. To again, there are challenges that Cuba faces, and there are plenty of, I think, valid criticisms of how Cuba is organized. But I would say areas where they're doing well are their healthcare system, and their education system. They have one of the highest literacy rates in Latin America for comparable countries. They created their own COVID vaccine. They have a program where they train doctors and send them out into the world to go work in areas of the world, the most impoverished areas of the world. The Elam Medical School is sort of world renowned for that work that they do. There's a community health center in every neighborhood in Cuba where you can go. The downside is, but due to the sanctions against Cuba and the challenges of their economy, they don't have all the medications. Like, you can't walk into a store and buy a jar of Advil or Tylenol. So there are downsides, but the way that their system works, they've got community health centers and in a qualified doctor in every neighborhood, and so doctors will make house calls. You can go there, you can get health care. You just might not be able to get the medicines that you need because of the shortages. But I think we can learn a lot from that. I think one of the things that students are really struck by when they first arrive in Cuba is arriving in a communist country that does not have advertising, for example. So, you know, walking down the street, there's no Pepsi or Coca-Cola advertisements. There are no billboards. It feels very different. So you see more like murals and community-based like art within different spaces to sort of fill that that space that we tend to fill with other things like advertisement. So that's one, I think, as well. The Cuba Study Away program is a homestay program, so all the students live with Cuban families, and I think that is, I think, really eye-opening for them to see the ways that individual Cuban families struggle for day to day, but also work together with the people in their neighborhood to make things work.
Yeah, I bet they come back appreciating US so much.
Yeah, they absolutely do.
Yeah,
You know, we try to
definitely.
prep them ahead of time about, the potential for rolling blackouts where the electricity will go out at times, and that you're not going to have the modern conveniences. Air conditioning is not ubiquitous in Cuba, and it's hot. It's tropical. We're there in summertime. So there are definitely things that they experience there that I think give them a new appreciation for everything that they have at home.
Yeah, I grew up in Armenia, which was part of
Okay.
the Soviet Union. I grew up in a communist society, and
Sure.
so
Yeah.
I was only 12 when I came to the States. And I, you know, when my friends who were born here complain about something,
Sure.
I'm like, please, you have no idea how good we have it, even with the issues that you're seeing with the government. And trust me, it is heavenly compared to what
Yeah.
People in these third world countries deal with, especially in a communist society.
Sure.
I
Yeah.
actually took my daughters on vacation to a few countries, third world countries, when they were
Yeah.
younger, just for them to have a different perception on life
Sure.
and
Yeah.
appreciation for things. And they're just, I think that really helped them appreciate everything in US, everything.
Yeah, I have not made it to Armenia yet, but
Yeah,
it's on my list.
oh yeah, it.
My neighbor across the street is
Oh,
Armenian, the family, and
nice.
he's a professor. He's a math professor, and he's got a home in Armenia. So he's invited us to go, and it's
You should
we're
take advantage and
hope to do it.
go.
Yeah,
The
yeah,
food, the history, there's just it's gonna be a wonderful, wonderful
yeah.
vacation. So in terms of your book, The Unsettling
Yeah.
Education, what idea has sparked the most debate and res or resistance from readers? I'm just curious to know either or.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good question. I would say, I think the one that I has gotten the most traction is the chapters on ungrading. So thinking about assessment sort of outside this framework of A, B, C, D, F, and really thinking about, are there ways that we can have students reflect on the work that they've done, in partnership with their peers and with their teachers, to identify like what's been meaningful about the work that they've done and sort of articulate for themselves what they feel like they've learned and what they still need to learn outside of this, system of, all of us who have been successful in school, we understand what we might call the grammar of schooling, which is just like, these are the hoops you jump through to get an A, and if I only jump through this many hoops, I know I'm going to get a B. And that can sometimes, I think, rob, education of its like authenticity, where you really
Great.
feel like, am I learning something valuable? Is this relatable? Is it relevant to my life? And so I think when we remove something like, the grading system, it pushes us, I think, in a direction to reconsider what a truly authentic educational experience would look like and what it would be about. I have these conversations with my students because I work in teacher education. They come into class often, like a lot of college students, like I did as a college student, and they come in and they think, if I show up and I do the bare minimum, like on the syllabus, so I do the things that are on the syllabus, and I do them, competently, that I should get an A. So then we start to like break that down a little bit and ask questions about like, well, if an A is, excellent, sort of outstanding work, like what would that mean for you as a student in this class to really perform above and beyond what your peers are doing? Because then you start to break down, okay, so then what does a B really mean? What does a C really mean? And if you had to assess yourself, and if you're and you're going to be assessing students in the future, and you're going to be asked to use these grade point systems, like what do we really mean by this? You know, are we really measuring the things that we value, or are we valuing the things that are easy for us to measure? And this comes from out of the work of a guy named Gert Biesta, who writes a lot about assessment. But this question, I think, is an important one for teachers to grapple with, because I think there's it's kind of like pulling back the curtain on assessment. You're as a student in a class, you know, you do your work and you magically get this grade on your paper. But as a teacher, you've got to really think about what do these things mean, and how do I want to apply them in a way that's really going to be conducive to, in my view, authentic learning. And that, I think, is a useful exercise for students to go through.
I love that, and I would love to continue this conversation separately. Especially as I'm looking at Redlands and the vision for 2032 to
Sure.
be the personalized,
Yeah.
lead the way in personalized education. So I feel like there's just so much connection here. I know we have less than maybe 4 minutes left here,
Sure.
and I have so many questions I still want to ask you, but hopefully not my last, but my next question is, what do you hope Redlands students take away from your classes beyond academic knowledge?
Oh gosh, yeah, that is a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, to me, I've succeeded as a professor if when the student comes into the class, they have a certain set of ideas about, let's say, teaching and learning. And when they leave the class, their perspective on those things has shifted in a meaningful way. So one of my mentors is a professor named Kevin Kumashiro, and he has a book called Against Common Sense. And in it, he has a diagram of a student going through a schoolhouse. And the traditional notion of like what learning is that, you know, there's like a cup of knowledge, let's say, and you go through the schoolhouse and you come out on the other end, and that cup is you know, has gone up. It's more full than it was when you started. In Kevin, in his book, he challenges us to think about education in a different way, which is you come in with a lot of assumptions about the world. And then school, you know, shakes that foundation a little bit. It challenges you to kind of shift your perspective. It gives you new critical lenses to look at things. And you come out on the other side, and that knowledge, it might have gone up, like there might be more of it there, but more or equally important is that your way of thinking about things has changed in some important way. And so, you know, I think that's a it's a it's ambitious to hope that that happens in every course. But that's really my goal, is to have a student start in one place and come out the other end with more questions about, you know, what it is they're up to as educators or future educators, and how they're going to go about their work and their life as teachers. I feel like I haven't done a great job if they come in and they've got sort of a set of ideas and they come out and it's exactly the same as when the course started.
Wow, that's a great answer. If a student is wondering why Redlands, what would your answer be?
Well, I think Redlands offers just so many opportunities. I mean, the faculty that I work with are just such the most dedicated and committed people that I know in the profession. And, you know, I've been able to do some really interesting things. At least I find them interesting, like from the study away courses to the inside out. And that is a testament, I think, to a faculty and in an environment that allows for that kind of innovation and that sort of personalization, those sort of high impact experiential like type of experiences. Those are the kind of things that I gravitated towards as a student, and so I try to replicate that for my students as a faculty member at Redlands. You know, and I think that's really where the power, resides, or that sort of transformative potential, that high impact potential, is for us as faculty to take the things that we're passionate about and put them into action so that students can have those types of experiences. And I found in my almost a decade now at the University of Redlands, has it's been a space that has allowed me to do those types of things.
Wow, thank you so much. I can't believe our time is up. And I would love to have you back again, Dr.
Sure,
Sharad.
anytime.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your amazing work with us. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me, Maria. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
My pleasure.